Welcome, welcome, welcome. That's six welcomes this week, as this is the second podcast of the week. A little bonus. I thought we'd kick January off hard. This is episode 249, and I'm joined by the wonderful Adam McKay. Really enjoyed this chat. I'm going to keep the intro brief because this is a bonus episode. So whilst it's a little bit shorter, I think you're happy with that. There's a lot of podcasts out, even on the Distraction Pieces Network. If you're a film fan, you will have on Wednesday had me talking to Mark Miller. And then on Thursday, you would have had Brett Goldstein's films to be buried with. And then today is another one. You've also got Off the Beaten Track today. You had Hardcore Listing on Monday. Tuesday Night Jaw, I'm recording this in advance, but they have quite possibly got their Hall of Fame / Matches of the Year episode out this week. So a lot for you to listen to. So I won't ramble on too much. The usual plugs apply. Head over to Speech Development Records.com. There's loads of good stuff over there. Patreon.com/ScroobiusPip if you can spare a dollar a month. The idea is that I heard Craig Parkinson describe it like this on Two Shot Podcast, which is a fantastic podcast. He said, if you were out and you saw me in a pub, would you come and buy me a drink to say thanks for the free podcast every week? If you would, just jump on the Patreon, because that's, I mean, for me particularly, that's a dollar a month. That means you buy me a drink every 3 or 4 months, depending on where you drink. It could be 5 or 6 months, because that's like 70p a month. So yeah, head over there, patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. I'm about to launch Poem of the Month over there, the first Monday of every month, where I record a spoken word piece I wrote over 10 years ago. I've gone through my old archives and found unreleased works and stuff like that. So that's all going on over there. But that's enough. You don't need to hear about that nonsense. I recommend you go and see Vice, though. We're about to talk about it. There's no spoilers. That's not how it works. Oh, it's a true story. So spoilers are the way the world has played out. But I loved it. It's in my films of the year already. I think it's a sure bet for being in there at the end of the year as well. It's fantastic. Head out and see Vice. But for now, I should also mention, on February 4th, Pod Bible magazine launches, and I'm helping out on that. It's a thing that Stuart Whiffin and Adam Richardson have made, and it's a free podcast magazine. We'll give you more details as we get closer to the date, but we will be handing out in person on February 4th at certain train stations in the morning and evening in London. And it's your free guide to podcast. And it's got interviews in there with Adam Buxton and Craig Parkinson, who I just mentioned. And there's just tons of recommendations and picks and tips from all over the place. So yeah, it's really good stuff. I think you'll enjoy it. And it's free. The free digital copy, the free physical copy launches on February 4th. The digital copy follows on February the 11th, the following Monday. But you can follow Pod Bible all over the internet. It's on Twitter, Instagram, all these places. So give us a follow and show some love if you're a fan of podcasts. I mean, in the time I'm doing this intro, after saying it be short, it's a long-ass intro, you could have gone and followed Pod Bible. So anyway, without further ado, I should mention the Polaroid on this one might look weird, yeah, because we the Polaroid wasn't right at the time, so we've used press photos to go in there. It's a bonus podcast. You can't complain about a few inconsistencies to the system. Chill. This is Adam McKay on the Distraction Pieces podcast. I always find the one thing that I can maintain is making sure that wherever I land, I try not to have a nap or sleep until actual bedtime. Other than that, I've not got the discipline to not eat on the plane. I'm watching films. I'm going to be eating loads of sweets and so on and so forth. So.
I tell you the one thing that's worked, and this is terrible. Yeah. My wife doesn't like it. Go out that night, that first night, and have a bunch of beers.
Yeah.
It kind of resets everything.
Yeah, because it's going to give you that clean sleep.
You know?
And that groggy wake up, but at least you're expecting it then. There's a reason for it to be a groggy wake up.
At least approximate some kind of routine. Anyway.
I love it. I'm joined today by Adam McKay. There's a lot I want to talk to you about, and we'll get round to loads of it. But we should start with Vice, as you're in the midst of the hype and excitement of that. How's that been, talking about it and seeing the reactions, both the praise and the Trumps walking out and stuff like that? How's that all been?
It's been a kick. I mean, this was one of the more challenging movies we've ever done. It obviously covers 5-6 decades of American history and one of the most mysterious, shadowy characters in American history. So we knew it was going to be difficult, and we knew it would get a divisive response, quite simply because everything does these days in the United States.
Particularly if you're talking about politics, rather than avoiding that, you've literally steered into it with film. Well, let's really get that. Let's see where they go.
So we kind of knew what we were asking for. But overall, it's been very exciting. I mean, it's really great to see young people who weren't that familiar with the history very turned on by the movie and really getting what it's doing. And then recently, there's a thing with a new attorney general they've been interviewing, and unitary executive theory keeps coming up.
Right.
And I'm seeing people on social media are talking about Vice because we deal with that as a central idea. So a lot of it's doing exactly what we wanted. But it is funny in the United States, man. It's like you get anywhere near government or religion or any of that stuff, and it's just the Red Sea parts.
I was talking to an author recently, and he was saying if you talk about anything political, as soon as it goes on social media, there becomes a ghost version of your book or of your – and it's a similar film. There will be a ghost version of the film that people who haven't seen it are furious about because they've decided what the points it's making, and you then have to kind of look at, am I going to defend against – what I haven't made, or because I still agree with that kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? It's that this weird thing of you don't even have to only defend your actual film, you have to defend what those who haven't seen it assume it to be.
I bit the hook a couple times on social media and immediately regretted it. Was like, what am I doing? But the one that drives me crazy is going, it's all a pack of lies. And I'm like, well, what's not true? Yeah. Like, I want them to list it. Oh, you liberals. I'm like, but what's not true? Like, tell me what's false. Like, and they won't list anything. That's the one that drives me crazy. But I have learned, for the most part, I only bite the hook a couple times. So, let it just be what it needs to be.
How, I mean, do you enjoy, in these last two films, tackling real life and true stories? Because I guess the story is already there, but then you have to find your route through that story and find the bits that excite you. Because it always annoys me when people get angry at anything that's left out of a biopic or anything like that. And it's like, it's not a documentary.
No.
It's a narrative. And it's something I want to talk about in the big short as well. I think there's a certain area of society who you can only reach through narrative films who wouldn't go and watch a documentary about Dick Cheney or a documentary about the financial crisis, but they will go and watch a blockbuster about it. So it feels, I think it's an underrated level of importance in tackling these stories. I thought it with Detroit and with numerous other films in recent years.
A large part of the reason we made this movie, that we felt like there was a lot of great books written about Cheney. There's some good documentaries, but really only the Oliver Stone movie W, and really that barely grazes on Cheney.
Yeah.
And you're right. For a lot of people, that becomes the record. There were obviously many other nuanced motivations for the movie, but that was definitely one of them. And there was a sense in America that we were ready to sweep those whole 8 years under the carpet.
Yeah.
People really had stopped talking about it. In fact, you even started hearing people say in regards to Trump, it kind of makes you miss W. Bush.
Yeah.
I would say, are you really kidding me? Like,
can I just remind you?
Being bitten by a dog makes you miss being bitten by a shark? Like, I don't. How about they're both terrible?
Like,
So, that was definitely part of the motivation of the film. And the cool thing is we're getting to see some of that come into action.
Yeah.
Where there's some people who didn't know certain things and they're talking about it, and you can see the exchanges happening and in social media, and you hear them anecdotally. So we're pretty happy with the reaction.
I think particularly in the UK, I'm excited for it to launch in the UK and that, because it is something that we're even more ignorant to a lot of these stories, to a lot of the stories in American.
Because
we get a wide brushstroke of just, he's a bad guy.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. You're not watching the news every day and getting all the small things that build up this character. You're just getting the Darth Vader character and not the
I hate to break it to you, but that's kind of all we're getting in the United States as well.
Yeah.
I think that's mostly what we get as well. I mean, I was amazed. And by the way, I'm talking about myself when I talk about the United States. Mm. I was amazed by how many of these details I didn't know. Mm. Once I started researching it, there were so many things I had no idea, like that he got the daily intelligence briefing before the president, that he was BCC'd on all his emails. I remember reading this stuff going, holy moly, this is crazy. There's a lot of that kind of stuff in there. And it'll be exciting for England because – you know, obviously you guys rode with us into that war, and I'm curious to see how people react here, and I can't wait. And usually I feel like the UK is pretty good, pretty on their politics and knows what's going on and are open to ideas. Not everyone, of course,
So did it kind of excite you as you delved into it? It's a thing that I found with Black Klansman recently and numerous other things, where you're making a historical piece, but so much of it mirrors the current situation. And with the kind of, the more I watched and the more I saw how blissfully ignorant W. Bush was compared to the people behind him, and it feels like a similar thing with Trump and a lot of the people, kind of the powers lurking in the shadows. Did that kind of motivate you to think, right, we're kind of telling two stories at once here? We're telling a bit of history, and we're also kind of doing a foreshadowing of, look what you could be missing.
Absolutely. And you know, the moment that really drove that home was when we have the speech, the actual speech from Ronald Reagan saying, make America great again.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember I had heard that he had said that. I had heard that it was a slogan. But when we actually found that footage, it took my breath away. It's just there were certain people in test audiences who thought we had CGI'd that footage to make them say it. They didn't believe it was real.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. They go, well, why did they change what Reagan was saying? It's like, no, that was – he had campaign buttons, make America great again. So that repeating of history kept smacking us in the face as we were making the movie. And the other thing that would happen is current events would loop right into the movie too. You'd be working on something – like we have a scene where they talk about John Bolton working with Cheney. And I said, you know, you can maybe cut that. I haven't heard John Bolton's name in a long time. And the next day, Trump has hired John Bolton. Like,
amazing.
That kind of stuff happened constantly.
It's beautiful because it means you don't have to be ham-fisted about it or hammer it home. You don't have to be going, look, you know, this is like, there's so much in there that you can just tell the history, and it's unavoidable from the viewer. So again, it will have those things that people in their mind will be saying, well, it's having a go at Trump and all this.
Yeah.
No, it's not mentioning or making a conscious comparison at all. It's just unavoidable.
Just the history. Yeah. I mean, there was an interesting discussion my editor and I had when we were doing the 1980s.
Yeah.
Where we wanted to just show a couple images of the 80s. So we had like Jane Fonda, we had Mr. T. And I told my editor, I go, honestly, if you were showing images of the 1980s, you'd put Donald Trump in there.
Yeah.
That's what Donald Trump is and was. He was like a B-level celebrity from the 1980s.
Yeah.
And I go, that's...
He was the archetypal rich guy.
Yeah.
He was the stereotypical.
He had a board game, and he was a cheeseball, and he was a joke in the 80s. And that's what Donald Trump is. And I go, let's put a picture of him in. And we just put a quick picture of Donald Trump in there. And like, in our minds, that's what Donald Trump is.
Yeah.
And we didn't make any effort for the rest of the movie ever to show him again. That was the only time you see him.
Yeah.
So we were constantly having that discussion. How much do you consciously loop? How much do you just play it by the period?
Yeah.
But it's also really fun too. I mean, you're going through 5-6 decades of American history, and
we're
learning while we're doing it because we're constantly researching and we're talking to journalists and, so it's just stimulating the entire process.
It's something I was going to ask about, the evolution of your scripts, because this and The Big Short in particular, it feels like they're so intricate and so they weave in and out of drama and comedy and almost parody and things like that, that it there needs to have been a flexibility in when you start moving on things rather than it, I mean, I'd imagine there's a long journey to get to here's our finished script because it's intricate, but then equally, is there a looseness then to go, we need to throw that out the window or change this?
You know, less so with The Big Short, because it was all – The Big Short had a ticking clock on it.
Yeah.
The ticking clock obviously being the collapse.
Yeah.
The Cheney did not. I mean, the Cheney was like a big, expansive life story.
Yeah.
So there were definitely some elements to the Cheney script that we had to cut that I really thought – I really wanted to keep. But they just wouldn't work. There was a whole section – about young Chaney and young Lynn falling in love as teenagers.
Right.
That I thought was vital to the movie, and we could not get it to work. We kept putting it in. We'd cut it short. We'd cut it long. We'd cut it medium. We'd flip the time, and the audience was just not having it. Yeah. They're like, look, we came here. It's bad enough you got us to come and watch a movie about a vice president. Now you're not even going to show us Christian Bale.
Yeah.
And so we did take that out, and the movie played much better once it was out. And then we had a crazy musical number where Rumsfeld taught Bale all the ins and outs of Washington, D.C., and that was another one. It just blew a hole in the movie. It was too much, too early, and we tried 6-7 times to keep that in, and that ended up going. Those were the two big things we lost. Yeah. I was like, ah. But all the other stuff tracks pretty well with what the script was. I mean, really, the last half of the movie is almost exactly what the script was. But, yeah, those two big pieces definitely came out.
And it must be hard to have pieces that you love but you have to accept don't add to the big picture.
Well, I got to tell you, what drove us crazy, and I gave him a hard time about it, our director of photography, Greg Frazier, he shot that footage of them as young teenagers. It looks so beautiful.
Yeah.
We shot it on film. Our production designer, Patrice Vermette, Susan Matheson with the wardrobe, the actors, it was so good that it just never occurred to us that it wouldn't be in the movie because it just looked like, you know, the movie Giant, or it looked like East of Eden or some kind of 1950s movie. And so when I saw Greg, I was like, you SOB.
Yeah.
You cost us 2 months of work because your footage looks so beautiful.
Yeah. That's what DVD extras are for.
It'll be on there.
I mean, we touched upon a social media briefly there, and there's too much film stuff I want to talk about to go too deep into the ups and downs of social media. But a thing that's been popular in the last week or two is the 10-year challenge of people looking at themselves 10 years ago and look at now. And I wanted to kind of do that with your career in a way, because it occurred to me that Step Brothers is a film that I loved, but it's so different from Vice. So how do you look at your script writing approach, your directing approach? Is there an element of greater confidence? Because it always feels in earlier work, I could be wrong, but it feels to me there's less that you take out because you're kind of just, let's do it. We've shown it. It's there. Let's do it. Whereas you need to mature as a director to be able to say, I know we've shot it and it looks beautiful, but it's not adding to the story. So how do you see kind of comparing you in the Step Brothers time to you making Vice?
You know, I feel like with Step Brothers and Talladega Nights, I started getting pretty good at like making movies. I started to really understand the interaction with the DP, how to use the camera to help a comedy, which is a very specific thing to do. So I always loved the way Step Brothers looked. I thought there's some great shots in that movie, the slow motion of them hitting each other in the heads with the bats.
The opening title
on that is my favorite opening title of any movie we did.
Right.
Where the Step Brothers letters come down, and it's the North American Scum song playing. It's one of my favorite opening titles. So that movie is the most fun I think I've ever had making a movie, Step Brothers, where every day I laugh so hard my body would be sore.
Yeah.
And for me, that's the most me, and I think Will feels this way as well. That's the movie that we love the most out of all those comedies, is Step Brothers. Because it's really is kind of like pure anarchy, pure just
100%.
Power chords, and like, let's just go for it. But compared to these movies now, yes, it's very different. I mean, in some ways, there's nothing harder than making a comedy in the way that all day long, your mind is working when you're doing a comedy. You're constantly thinking of, you don't want to get pinned in with a bad joke, so you're always getting alternatives. You're always shooting it differently. Your mind is going much harder when you're doing a comedy. Whereas when you're doing something that can be dramatic or funny or whatever, it's a much more relaxed vibe, and you're going for much more nuanced moments, and things don't feel rushed. And I joked when I first started doing The Big Short, I was like, this is fantastic. This feels very European. And we would finish an hour early and we would go home. And it was really lovely is what it was.
It must be a tough one on comedy to kind of decide, is this funny or are we just having fun? And they're not always the same thing. If you're in the moment, if it's working with friends, working with hilarious people.
Always get it, though. If you're having fun, always film it.
Yeah.
Always
film
it, because it does increase the chances that it's good.
Yeah.
If you guys are really laughing, if we're really laughing at something, it doesn't mean it's going to work.
Yeah.
But the odds do go up.
Yeah.
And, you know, with our rule was just get everything. I mean, I think we shot over 1 million feet of film for Step Brothers.
Oh, wow.
But what was the difference if you do the 10-year thing, huh? Well, I think the difference, honestly, yeah, I think I've become a better filmmaker. There's no question. I've done a lot more. But I also think the difference is in the world. I just think the world is such a radically different place 10 years ago to now.
Of course.
And in a way, that's kind of really what's changed things. I don't know if I make Vice if the world hasn't done what it's done, you know? If the world stayed pretty much relatively the same, I'd probably still be making those types of comedies, but they just don't feel like they quite fit where we're at.
Yeah, no, I agree. That makes complete sense. How is it kind of, what's your approach as a director when you're directing performances like in Vice? Obviously, Christian Bale is getting rightfully buckets of praise. Sam Rockwell as well. He's one of my favourites for years. But to see him in a role like this is just, it blew me away. But Steve Carell, a previous guest on here, Eddie Marson, just so many great performances of people who find the exact right balance of not just doing an imitation. Because again, it's tough when it's real life people. Mm-hmm. You don't want to just go in and do an impersonation. You want to, find the you in them and draw that out.
Yep, exactly.
So well how do said. You approach that as a director? And do you sit back and kind of go, look, a Christian Bale, from what I've heard, knows what he's doing. You know, the dude can
definitely act. Definitely. So, I mean, the fun of it for me is that I've done all this research. I have ideas about the characters. So the fun of it is I get to sit with actors like Bale and Amy Adams and talk for 2-3 hours and kick around ideas and just bat it around. What is the character? And really what you're looking for, you're right. And I told all the actors this. Don't feel like you have to do an impersonation. What you want is that emotional kinetic that is the person. You just want to feel that like you're in the right key of that person. You don't have to be exactly that person.
Yeah.
And of course, once an actor frees themselves up like that, of course, then they start really seeming like the person, which they all kind of did. But so there's a lot of conversations. There's a lot of sharing of research. And then on the day, you know, usually the first 3 or 4 takes, these are very, very good actors. I leave them alone and I'm doing my work as far as getting the camera where it should be, getting the rhythm. We might be changing blocking. Sometimes as a writer, I'll just notice some of the dialogue isn't working. And so one of the first things I'll say is, that doesn't feel right. Why don't you try freeing that line up? And you're just trying to get everything to work for that first circle take.
Yeah.
And that's usually 3-4 takes to get that. And then you get that first circle take and you get, or maybe it's 5 or 6, and you've had that brilliant performance from Bale, from Amy Adams, from Rockwell, whoever it is, Tyler Perry. And you're good because now you know you got it.
Yeah.
And then we screw around.
Yeah.
Then we play around. Then I'll come over and talk to the actor and go, oh, that's interesting. But, you know, there is another way to do this.
Yeah.
And it's not how I wrote it and it's not how you played it. But do you want to fuck around with it a little bit? And always they do, of course. Yeah. And then it gets fun. Then it's like, wait about this. And we've had times where we've ended up changing the entire scene because of that. But it's all about getting that first take that's the written, that's what's the – so everything we've prepared, get that. And then once you have it, no rules, let's play around. And so many times, of course, that's where the best stuff comes from, is that after the circle take.
Yeah. Do you find there's a difference in that in between TV and film? Because I act as well, and I've done a couple of films recently, but the biggest things I've done have been TV for BBC and FX and stuff like that. And it feels like in TV there's, I guess because of the turnover of these things, there's less time to play around. It feels like, we've got that,
TV's
so
rough.
Let's move on. Whereas with film, it genuinely, as an actor, it had me excited there. The thought of you saying, oh, we've got that, let's keep going and have fun, rather than we've got that, and let's move on. That was kind of instantly like, imagine that opportunity.
It's the best.
Yeah.
And actors love it. I love it. The DP loves it. Everyone loves it. Because we're good. We
and
got
it. The pressure's
it.
Off then,
it's
right?
It's off.
The pressure's off so you can enjoy it.
And now we can really go a little. Now that we're all dressed up in these costumes and we got all the lights set up, let's see what else is here. And that's where you dig. You know, there are plenty of times you walk away going, you know what? The circle take was the best. But I'd say, you know, 60, 65% of the time, it's always what you find after that. And I've done TV before too. Yeah, and I'm totally with you. It's brutal. Yeah. 2-3 takes, move on. Yeah. There is something kind of fun about the TV though, because you're moving so fast. There is a looseness. There is a feeling of like, just screw it. We're going for it. We're moving. Yeah. I did kind of enjoy that aspect.
A lack of analysis, of paralysis analysis.
Exactly.
So if it goes right, that's beautiful. If it doesn't, then you've got that, we should have spent longer on that.
Exactly. I got to work on a pilot, and the pilots are nice because they give you extra days. So we got to shoot it like a film.
Yeah.
But yeah. That's usually it. And then there are scenes like we did the Shakespeare scene, and we did much more of it than what you see in the movie. It's sort of a shortened version of it. But with that one, I just let them go. I just let Amy and Christian do take after take after take. And then I would give them just little notes. Just, can you try this? Or when you get this, make sure to hit this part a little more. Otherwise, keep going. And that was more, sometimes you'll just pound a scene with takes. You'll just let the – and then I'll check in with the actors. How are you feeling? I feel like that was it. All right, so now you're good. Okay, how are you feeling? You know, and you just take after take. Because there are times you're not going to change the words. And there are times you're not going to change the blocking.
Yeah.
And then there was rare moments where you do like 2 or 3 takes and you go, we're good. And everyone gets very excited by that too.
Yeah, because again, there is that potential of clocking off early. That, no matter how much you enjoy your job, you're living the dream. There's that, oh, we're going to – be back at the hotel early. This is the best. Cool.
Yeah, I don't need too much, but 45 minutes, an hour, awfully nice. And you're saving money.
It makes a difference. Yeah. The reason I did a show called Taboo, and the reason my role grew in that and I'm in the next series is because every time I was wrapped early, my excitement then was to watch everyone else because I didn't go to drama school or any of that stuff. So I'm new to this. So I'm like, I've rapped as a character, but I get to watch Tom Hardy and Stephen Graham and all these people and learn from them. So I'd be like, I want to rap early because I know there's other scenes that I want to just watch and be part of. And that kind of, it went down well. And I'll be honest, it got me more scenes because they were often, like, it felt as if I was sitting on the sideline in full kit, just going like, I'm ready to come in. So if they suddenly realise, oh, we need someone here, they're like, let's put Pip in. So
well played.
Jump in extra.
Yeah.
How do you go about the casting process of things like this? Because as I said, it's tough when it is a biopic or a real life thing, because there is always going to be at the back of your mind a natural propensity to go, oh, he looks like him or she looks like him, rather than, oh, they're the right actor for it, they're going to do the right performance. How's that come about? And is that something that you're hugely involved in, or is that casting directors and producers and everything else? Obviously you produce as well on it.
Yeah.
I imagine you've got a lot of
we have Francine Maisler, who's like one of the best casting directors. And then I would say in general, there are a bunch of names you know right away. Like when I'm writing the script, before I've even talked to Francine,
perfect,
I know it's Christian Bale. I know I want Sam Rockwell. I'm thinking about Amy Adams. I'm thinking about Carell. There's like a bunch of names that are kind of floating around. And then I never worry about them looking too much like him. You just don't want them to like look wrong. Like you don't want to cast a 70-year-old Samoan man as, you know.
It's the balance, isn't it?
Yeah, you want to be in the rough ballpark, you know. So like, you know, Bale doesn't look anything like Chaney, but I knew, you know, Bale, you know, he can get there, you know, he can get the vibe. And I knew that would be part of the fun of it. And Rockwell actually does kind of look like Bush. That was convenient. And I also thought he was the perfect actor.
I wouldn't have picked it at all until I saw it on screen. I'd never seen that in Rockwell. I haven't seen everything he's done and studied his performances. As soon as he was on screen, I was like, that's just Bush. He's got no everything. Yeah. Like,
insane. But Amy looks almost nothing like Lynn Chaney, but the attitude was just perfect, on point. So, as long as it's roughly in the ballpark, that's all I really cared about. And then these hair and makeup people can give you a little dash of something that just points it. But, if it becomes like just impersonations, it can get – but, man, these actors are so good. They all got there. I mean, I'll tell you, the guy who blew me away is Tyler Perry.
Yeah.
Tyler Perry as Colin Powell. How about that?
Yeah, like, absolutely.
I mean, he walked on set. People thought Colin Powell was walking on set.
Yeah.
And that was crazy. So,
and the subtlety of his performance. And, I mean, I guess it's also the subtlety of the way the character's written into it. But He's not in it that much, but he has such an impact and such a lasting
effect. That guy can act. That guy's a really good actor. We're gonna see a lot more of him in serious roles, in surprising roles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was really blown away by him.
Yeah, I love that. So, I mean, speaking of great actors, I guess when you find those people who are great and you know that you can work with them, which I think is an under-talked about key part of filmmaking as well, is if you can spend months together and not be, you know, accept their view, them accept your view, all this kind of thing. You worked with Bale and Carell on The Big Short as well. You added in two of the most talented heartthrobs in film history in Brad Pitt and Ryan Gosling. Happened to be gorgeous, but goddamn can they act.
So
how was that to tackle as well? Because that was, to give context for anyone who doesn't know, it was your first time stepping away from working with Will Ferrell, and it felt like such a difference in departure. I don't know if you ever read there was a comic book called Super Crash, and I was a judge on the Independent Comic Awards panel that year.
Oh, cool.
And it did similar to what The Big Short did, in that it spoke about a really complex and, let's face it, probably boring subject. I mean, the fact that it's boring is the reason it went so bad, because people would rather ignore it.
Exactly.
It spoke about that, but made it, number one, understandable, which is the first big task, but even more so with The Big Short, enjoyable, entertaining, funny. How was that? Because at that point, you're embarking on an unprecedented task. Generally, films about that kind of thing are dry Oscar-targeted things. And this was anything but. It was still had the humour, and the way you cut out of or broke the fourth wall and cut out of reality and things like that was just, it was amazing. How was that
approach? I felt really confident about the approach to it. I felt really confident about the script, about the movie I could make. But the part that surprised me was when, you know, because still I'm a guy known for comedy, so we have the script Big Short. Paramount reads it. They like it. But what does this really mean? You know, it's still the guy who's done Anchorman and Step Brothers. And I said, look, why don't you let me take a crack at some casting? I'm thinking of these actors, and I name these highfalutin actors. And I'm sure they're thinking, no way he's getting them.
Yeah.
And in 1 week, we got, what was it? First guy in was Bale. Then it was Ryan Gosling. And then it was Pitt. I think those were the first three that were in. And in 1 week. And I was a bit shocked. Amazing. I couldn't believe it. I mean, that's that crazy dream list that you go for and you know everyone's going to say no. Then you go to the second list and they actually said yes.
Yeah.
And we went back to Paramount and they were shocked. And they were like, I guess we're making this movie.
You've done it.
So the Ryan Gosling I had met before, and he's really cool and easy to hang out with. Carell I've known forever. Pitt, too, really just affable, easygoing guy. The guy I was kind of intimidated by was Bale. I didn't know him.
Yeah,
and
he's got a reputation, or a mixed reputation, a confused, inflated reputation as this artist that...
Totally. Well, he is.
I think, this is going to be...
He's a serious artist. Yeah. He's played these roles that are just intimidating and amazing. And let's face it, we all look up to him, and I just didn't know him. So he was the one guy I was like a little gingerly with, like, can I joke around? Can I do this? So I would just ask him everything. I go, I like to use a microphone on set, but I don't yell into it. I'm very calm in the mic. Yeah. Is that okay? Yes, that's all right. And we did a couple days. We worked 3 or 4 days and it was going great. And he was amazing, of course, and getting along. And I was like, screw it. I'm gonna make a joke with this guy. And so we're doing this big...
Surely the nerves are off.
Literally. I'm like, screw it. I think I even told my producer, I go, screw it. I'm gonna fuck around with him. Let's see what happens.
I remember the first time I was on set and I'd come up with an improvisation and we'd done like 10 takes and I had a small role. So I was like, I'm going to do it. I've never been more nervous.
Yeah.
It went down well and it made it in, but it was that kind of, I know it's good, but fuck.
Am I wrecking something that's already working?
Yeah.
Am I
going to ruin the mood? So how was that?
So it's a big moment. It's his character in the end of the movie who everyone's been doubting the entire movie, going, you're crazy, you're crazy, you're crazy. And he's losing money and he's losing money and he's losing money. And finally, in the end, the crash happens. He was proven right. And he writes on his board. He's been writing on his chalkboard dry erase board, the whole movie, where his company's at. It's always been minus 20, minus 30, minus 20. And then in the very end, he writes like plus 1,496. And then the character just writes that, and he turns, and there's a long shot of him just walking out of the empty office because everyone's been fired.
Yeah.
The company's fallen apart, but he was right. And it's a big shot. It's the end of the movie.
It's huge, yeah.
So we do 3-4 shots of it. There's no lines, but there's a camera move to it. So Barry Aykroyd was our DP on that movie, and he gets it. It looks great. Bale's performance, spot on. So I was like, all right, I'm going to fuck with him. So I walk up to him, and I go, that was great, Christian. It was great. He goes, yeah, it feels good. And I go, just because we got it, do you want to do one where right when you turn to walk out, look at the camera, just kiss the tips of your two fingers, give a little peace sign, and just go, peace out. And there's like a pause. And he goes, and I go, yeah, just look at the camera and just, peace out. And he goes, I don't know if my guy would really do that. And I go, oh, no, Christian, I'm fucking with you. And he goes, and then it was on. And then it was like, turns out Christian loves bits. And from then on, we're doing bits.
I love it because it's beautiful because as well, the panic of that is everything you've said previously. You're the guy who did Step Brothers and Commander. Yeah. So that is viable. And at that point, you've not proven yourself as this other kind of
guy. Exactly. Exactly. And I was like, I'm fucking
saying, here's what I want you to do.
Totally. He didn't know me well enough. And then from then on, Bits, all through that movie, all through the next movie. Yeah, Christian's hilarious and loves to joke around.
It's great to hear because you hear a lot about how if you're having, it's something that has happened in history in the past that some of the best films have come from really tense sets, from really conflicted sets, from people enjoying themselves. But it's great to hear, obviously, you kind of assume it on your Anchormans and stuff like that because you've got. Right. You've got all these people who are just clearly going to be having fun, but it's great to hear on these heavier and bigger ones that you can still make this great, important and powerful work and enjoy your day at work, enjoy the people you're around.
The trick is always, and you know the answer, is hire really good people.
Yeah.
If you hire really good people, you're good.
Yeah.
You know, we have amazing DPs, costume, AD, everyone's just amazing. So I don't need to be micromanaged, stressed out guy because I know I have the best of the best. Yeah. You know, if you told me I had to go direct a student film, God bless student films, I might be a little more stressed. Yeah. I might say like, why is the camera there? Hey guys, come on, for real. We got to do this. Although who knows? Maybe they're good students and it's a wonderful day. But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When people are that good, it tends to allow you to relax. With comedy, it was always the point, and Will and I would talk about it, be like, you can't have a stressed out set for comedy. It's going to hurt the comedy. Like you have to have a loose set.
Yeah.
You have to be laughing. You have to be able to make mistakes.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to be able to swing and miss.
Yeah.
Because if you can't and people tighten up, the movie's going to be less funny. Like, you know, I used to say when we were doing Anchorman and Step Brothers, go, we're not making Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Apocalypse Now is a movie. Probably freak out on that set a little bit. Like, you know,
yes,
Martin Sheen had a heart attack. Yeah. They're using real dead bodies.
Yeah.
The Filipino army comes and takes the helicopters because there's a war. You'll probably freak out on Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
We don't need to freak.
To panic.
Yeah. We don't need to freak out on Anchorman or Step Brothers. Come on. Everyone relax.
I love it. So, obviously, as I said, there's tons I want to talk about, but one person I wanted to talk about in particular is Mark Wahlberg, because Mark Wahlberg is someone that I use as an example. And I use other guys as an example all the time of the rare and unpraised skill of being able to do comedy at the top level and being able to do drama at the top level. And obviously he went on to do Ted and things like that as well. But at that point, The Fighter and the other guys, it wasn't, I think everyone who's a serious actor thinks that they could probably do comedy, and everyone who's a comedic actor might want to ever go at serious stuff, but it's not as easy a crossover as it would seem. So how was that to work with Mark and to find the fun and to find the humor?
Well, it all came, we had a dinner with, I kept telling Farrell, I go, you know, something about that Mark Wahlberg, that I just think the two of you would be interesting together. You know, I'm a huge fan of Boogie Nights. And I told him, I go, you know, Boogie Nights, that's a funny movie.
It's amazing.
Like,
there's
great comedy in that movie. If you score that movie differently, it's a comedy.
Look Good, Feel Good is one of the best comedy lines ever. When he's just keeping saying, look good, feel... If Ferrell was saying, look good, feel good before he goes out.
It'd be a catchphrase. Yeah. So I'm like, I'm telling you, that guy's funny, man. Yeah. And so he's like, all right. And I go, let's have dinner with him. So we had dinner with him. And the two of them sat next to each other. And after the dinner, I go, there is an energy between the two of you that just makes me laugh. Like, you get the sense that, like, Wahlberg would kick your ass, but you wouldn't fight him. So then Wahlberg doesn't have to worry about kicking your ass. Like, there's just a funny thing between the two of you. It's kind of awkward. It kind of works. It works because it doesn't work at all. Like, I can't imagine the two of you guys just hanging out. And I go, we got to do a movie. That's just, and what's great about Wahlberg is he's like, at the end of the day, he's just a professional. So I talked to him about doing comedy. I go, you know, it's actually not, some of it's not that hard, Mark. Just play it all real.
Yeah.
I go, that's all you got to do. Play everything real. And then if there's
It's hard to get people to do, though, if they think they're doing comedy. Because you want to play for laughs. And that's what makes him great, is he will come in and he'll believe that character. And that's,
And that's exactly what he did. And there was a couple times where I go, all right, you know, I said, play real. This one, push it a little bit. Or this one, you can do it more like that. I would just occasionally tell him, we're breaking our own rule here. But 99.7% of the time, play it real.
Yeah.
And that's what he did. And he was great. And the two of them together just made us laugh, man. They were just a funny, odd energy. Yeah. And that was all Wahlberg started improvising the bit with Eva Mendes about, this is your wife? No, really. Where's your wife? Where's your wife? Bye, Sheila. And kept saying bye, Sheila. And he kept doing that to the point where I thought he's doing it too much. And even Wahlberg's like, you think I'm doing that too much? There you go. You might be. He goes, I'm telling you, it's going to be funny. And then he was right. It was hilarious. So not only was he good at playing comedy, he even started improvising.
Brilliant.
And just a totally cool guy to hang, no drama, like just a pleasure to have on set. And and that's it. They've done, what, three movies together? I think they're planning a fourth. I mean, it's crazy. Amazing. One of the most unlikely pairs you'd ever see in your life. And they're having like this run together.
Completely. And that was also in parts of that, I'm sure I'm not misremembering this, but of an early turn for Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who's gone on to, again, prove people that he's not your kind of, in the late 80s, early 90s, when Hulk Hogan was doing Suburban Commando and Mr. Nanny.
Yeah.
He's not that. He's this genuinely, amazingly, and I think the Jumanji film recently has been one of the great examples of that. It was everyone on paper was like, we don't want a new Jumanji film.
Yeah.
And then it happens. It's fantastic. The Rock's just good. An engaging guy, and he's funny.
How good was that movie?
Yeah, it's great.
It was like a pure, I watched it with my daughters. We had the best freaking time. It was like fantastic.
And I loved the original, so I was skeptical when I heard about it. And I was like, this is wonderful. This is.
We had the same thing. My producer's like, you know, I can get Dwayne Johnson. We were doing the other guys. I was like, Dwayne Johnson? Really? Because we got Sam Jackson. Like, that's cool.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm telling you, Dwayne Johnson's great. And I was like, all right. And then Dwayne Johnson showed up. I'm like, that guy is the greatest guy I have ever met in my life. I will do anything with him. He's funny. He's a badass. He's like, he blew us away so much. We couldn't believe it. We were shocked how funny he was too. And no, I would do anything with that guy. And I had the same thing. I know exactly what you mean. Early on, you weren't quite sure which way it was going to go. And
completely. You'd had a lot of wrestlers basically move into a bit of acting, and it was always kind of, you're basically being a wrestler in it. And Dwayne Johnson was the opposite of that.
The joke I have with Christian Bale, we all have, is that Christian Bale asked his kids, be honest with me, would you rather Dwayne Johnson was your dad? And his daughter's like, don't ask us this, Dad. And he's like, honestly. And she's like, yeah, we would. So I asked my daughters, and they're like, of course.
I would pretty much swap anyone in my life for
Dwayne Johnson.
Any role.
Any role. I would, if I were going into serious surgery, I would switch my doctor for Dwayne Johnson, knowing it ups my chances of dying by 35%. Like, Dwayne Johnson is better as any person than they are as themselves.
Laughter is the best medicine. Dwayne The Rock Johnson is the best medicine.
Exactly. Forget my gallbladder.
I'll wrap things up now. I just want to kind of end on kind of saying how was it when, because I think people misremember the early days of your career a little bit, because Anchorman and Step Brothers and all of these, they weren't these big instant hits. They were these kind of slow burning things that became cult classics. And same with, it was at the same time as the Funny or Die stuff and that kind of thing. It was all just burning. So how is it to kind of have that thing now where, because again, you can look and go, well, he's done tons of huge films. You're now doing these films that from the start have that pressure to be a big thing, a lot of attention, rather than potentially, always look at it as the Kevin Smith kind of method, where all of his films, I love them, but you forget that they were tiny box office and then became these cult things on DVD.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So how is that now, having that different
I never feel that. The pressure is always just the movie. The pressure is in making the movie. I don't really ever think about the response or, oh my God, it has to be right because of that. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's probably one of the lucky things about I've been doing it a long time now.
Yeah.
So it's really everything's just about making the movie.
Yeah.
And there could be pressure within that. You can get stuck on something with the story. You can get, you know, a script can stall. So I don't ever really think of it in those terms. And even those comedies, even though you're right, they were all like kind of moderate hits that then got way bigger afterwards. They were still like, you know, Talladega Nights cost like $75 million, and other guys was like $100 million. So, I mean, there's some big budgets for those movies.
So the pressure's there.
But even with those, we didn't feel any pressure. We just felt like, you know what? If you're going to feel pressure, it's going to mess up the comedy. And like, so you're losing right away. So we just kind of decided, like, screw it. Let's just go make it and laugh our asses off. And whatever happens, happens. And we'll do our best, you know?
That's perfect. Well, I'm going to stop there just to remove any pressure in future interviews today because of time restrictions. So thank you very much for your time. It's been
such
a pleasure,
man. Great talking with you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There you go. That was Adam McKay. What a lovely chat, right? I mentioned that, you know, I'm often nervous when it's a guest I've not met before and when it's an American guest. I also know that on press junkets, everyone else is getting 5, 10, 15 minutes. I'm getting 40 or 45 minutes or an hour. So there's some pressure on me to deliver there to kind of go, oh, there's a reason I'm getting all this time. I'm all right at this, I swear. So yeah, I was really pleased with that conversation. I loved talking to Adam. I didn't plug myself too much, you know. Obviously, after I finished, I kind of did have a mention of like, yo, I'd love to work with you down the line. But yeah, it was a good chat. I really enjoyed it. I will see you all next week, guys. Thank you. Or I'll see a lot of you tomorrow if you're listening on Friday at the book club. We Are Lizards at the book club. Come down. I love the fact that since the podcast has launched, we're getting tons of people at the book club who are podcast fans and come to chat and to hang out and to meet me, Stu, Chris, and have a lovely time. So, yeah, come be part of that. It's blooming lovely. I'll see a lot of you at the book club. Come say hello. Ask for photos. If you want stuff signed, bring it along. But bring a pen with you. I don't have a pen. I'm there getting drunk. Earlier you get there, the more likely I can have a chat and hang out. If it's later in the night, I'll be drunk and it'll be rammed and noisy. So ain't much going down. Yeah. See you all next week. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.